It is such a pleasure to be here. And thank you all for coming. It's a delight. I realize it's been about a month since I've been with you. And so it's sweet to be back. And I was talking with Sylvia Boorstein a couple of days ago, and many of you know her, of course. She started this class probably 30 years ago and sends her love to everybody, really sends her love. All right, so our morning together, how we are going to do this, we'll start very shortly with an arriving meditation. And then after that, I'll offer a few Dharma thoughts about the day, about our practice, and then we'll move into our longer meditation. Then we'll have a break. I'll offer a Dharma talk. And after the Dharma talk, we'll have time to talk with each other. Let's settle right into an arriving meditation. And in this way, finding a posture, whether you're seated, standing, lying down, maybe you're even doing a slow walking meditation as a way to arrive. Whatever it is, find that comfortable posture. Maybe look around your space before you close your eyes, if closing your eyes is your practice. And just take in the environment. I like doing that. Even though I sit in the same place so often, I often see something new. So just take that in. And then as you're ready, inviting the eyes to close, or having a soft, gentle gaze downward, whichever you prefer. Noticing sounds around you. Might be the sound of my voice, sounds inside the room where you are, or maybe sounds further away, just allowing the hearing to open up. And turning the awareness inward to sense the body, to sense those touch points, wherever the body is making contact with either the floor or the furniture, whatever it is, just notice. And the breath, connecting with the breath, noticing the inhale and the exhale. And inviting the mind to join with this present moment experience with a quality of openness, warmth and kindness, a willing, soft receptivity of mind. Inviting the mindfulness. And then holding just enough energy in the back of the body to stay upright and awake. And allowing the front of the body to soften. Let it all relax so there's room to breathe. As Roshi Joan Halifax says, strong back, soft front. And from this beautiful posture, we welcome ourselves and welcome one another into practice. Good morning again. Welcome again. So I'd like to invite a couple of responses here. So I wanted to just check in with you. When I offered that short meditation instruction, strong back, soft front, what did you notice? Or did you notice any kind of response inside yourself to strong back, soft front? So this kind of, I'm asking this question because the imagery is important and the felt sense of it is important. This is part of how we arrive and start making the connection to there's an actual sensation on some level, in some way, or thought that happens in response to an instruction. So I want to talk more about this piece of strong back, soft front as we go forward today. The Abhidhamma is the expansive teachings on Buddhist psychology. And there are many principles in the Abhidhamma. And the first principle says, see the inner nobility and beauty of all beings. See the inner nobility and beauty of all beings. That includes us. And you know, sometimes when we hear something like that, see the inner nobility, it might be that we go outwards. We might think that doesn't apply to us. But this is an instruction that applies to us. And so our posture, we start with our posture. What is the posture that we assume when we come into a practice of cultivating presence, tending to both the mind and the heart and the body? We take a posture of nobility, of dignity. And when you can come into that sense of literally, what does nobility and dignity feel like in your body? Do you even sense that in your body? And these are reflection questions for you, is just to drop this in and notice. Oftentimes we talk about an uprightness of mind in our meditation practice, to notice what does that mean for you. And it's not necessarily uprightness of being vertical, because we know that lying down is an equally valuable meditation posture as keeping the spine vertical. The spine can be horizontal, and there can be a very real sense of dignity and nobility in that posture. And then when we offer the instruction to relax, to finding a comfortable posture in which your dignity and nobility can rise, and yet at the same time, relax. What that does, what does that do? For me, what that does is it welcomes me into practice. It gives me the sense of, I belong here. I belong here. Not only do I belong here, and the here is in my own presence of mind, in my own heart, exactly as it is, with Sangha, with whomever is here. That this is the connection and belonging that I think that dignity and nobility is pointing to. And then that expands from not only what is the posture of the body, because whatever the posture of the mind is often reflected in the posture of the body, right? So when I know for myself, when I'm feeling well, it's brightness of mind, a curiosity, a willingness, my body reflects that. When I don't feel that way, you know, it might be kind of slouchy. And that's just how it is. And there's nothing wrong with that. Slouchy mood, slouchy body. I mean, you know, that doesn't mean that we still don't belong and we're not still showing up. But what our meditation practice is inviting us to do is to tap into that inner nobility and dignity, to know that this is such a beautiful and important and right practice. So this avenue into our lives, not only what is the posture of the mind reflected in the posture of the body, but then let's take it into the question of what is the posture of our lives? How do we spend our time? How do we show up? And that's what we'll talk about later this morning and expand the definition of wise livelihood into meaning how we really show up in our lives. I want to start with a story. One of the teachers who I love very much is Jan Chosen Bays, and she is a Zen priest and teacher in Oregon, and she has this fantastic book called The Vow-Powered Life, if you're interested in that kind of thing, about what does it mean to make deep commitment, The Vow-Powered Life. So here's a story from the book. In 1666, the Great Fire destroyed 80% of the homes in London. St. Paul's Cathedral, built in the 11th century over 160 years, was destroyed. The great architect, Christopher Wren, was hired to rebuild the cathedral. Work started in 1669 when Wren was 37 years old, and the first service was held in the church when he was 65. He received the second half of his promised salary at the age of 79, when the church was completed. Who among us would have a vow powerful enough to continue working on a project for 32 years at half salary? I don't know if I would. It's a good question. There's an interesting story from the time of rebuilding St. Paul's. One morning, Wren, who was not personally known by many of the workers, stopped and asked three different laborers, all engaged in the same task, what they were doing. The first said, "I'm cutting this stone." The second answered, "I'm earning 3 shillings 6 pence a day." And the third man straightened up, squared his shoulders, and still holding his mallet and chisel, replies, "I am helping Sir Christopher Wren build this great cathedral." Now talk about dignity and nobility and being committed to something larger than ourselves, connecting and belonging and showing up with that kind of posture. So we can start with our sitting practice as the ground that helps us keep showing up. So let's sit. Let's sit. Take on this posture of dignity and nobility. So once again, finding a posture in which you'll be comfortable for a little while. We'll sit for about 25 minutes, maybe 30. We'll sit. Whether you're seated, standing, lying down, or maybe you even choose walking meditation for this time. Know you have a right to be here. Everybody is welcome exactly as you are, allowing your whole self to show up. Many Buddhist texts begin, "O nobly born, you who are the sons and daughters of the awakened ones, the Buddhas and the Bodhisattvas, remember your innate goodness, the luminous mind. Trust it. Return to it. It is home. Dropping in the awareness to any sense of home that you sense in your body, in your heart. Letting this posture be noble, dignified, with a gentle uprightness of mind, strong back, soft front. Soft front so there's room for the heart and room to breathe. And then finding for yourself that place where you can settle your awareness, whether it's on the breath, wherever you feel it the most in the body, or if the breath isn't the place that's comfortable for you, perhaps it's the hands or the feet, a place in the body that's at ease where you can rest. The mind will naturally wander, of course. Let it not be a problem. Try not to struggle with that. When the mind wanders, come back with gentle persistence, returning the awareness to that spot that works for you, and begin again. And we'll sit quietly. If the mind feels especially jumpy or sleepy, it might need a little bit more to do, a little stronger anchor to hold steady. A couple of ways to do that with the breath. One way is to count each exhale up to 5. If you get lost between 1 and 5, simply start again at 1. You might say quietly, silently to yourself, in, out, as you breathe. Or you might get very close to the breath, noticing very intentionally the beginning, middle, and end of the inhale, likewise the exhale, and even noticing that lovely pause before the next breath begins. That can help a sleepy or jumpy mind. If you've chosen sensation in the body as your anchor, get a little closer to it. Really noticing, what are those sensations like? You might name for yourself pulse, vibration, anything like that. Maybe there's an ache or a tingle. Getting closer to your experience as a way to stabilize the mind. from wherever you are, noticing any amount of stillness or ease that has come about. Is there an ease and stillness in the body and the mind? And just allowing that to spread any amount. And in that ease and stillness, is there still this current of nobility and dignity that holds it all together? And then moving the awareness, inviting the awareness to come into the heart now. Sensing the whole heart center, the space of the center of the chest, the center of the upper back. Remembering the upper back, the back of the heart, even the sides, that space of the heart center, the sides of that space, perhaps the physical side ribs up to the armpits, and allowing this energetic heart center to be whatever size it is, whatever shape it is. Can you sense the nobility and dignity of heart? What is that like? If you like, imagine breathing in and out of this heart space as you inhale, drawing fresh energy, breath into the heart space from every direction. And as you exhale, exhaling out into every direction. And through this heart's breath, this nobility and dignity of heart arises and stabilizes. Maybe it gets a little bit bigger, more spacious. The heart has a little more capacity. Tending the heart in this way. Try that for a few minutes if you like. And as you breathe this heart's breath, allowing the corners of the mouth to turn up just a little bit. A slight smile to come across the face, which actually relaxes the facial muscles. Just notice. And right in this space of this beautiful heart, just as it is, offering yourself some words of kindness. May I feel safe. May I feel peace. May I feel strength. May I be at ease. And just notice how that lands in the body and in the heart to offer yourself safety, peace, strength, and ease. And then likewise, we send those same blessings outward, bringing somebody to mind who could use a little extra care. May you too feel safe, peaceful, strong and at ease. Let the heart expand. To see the inner nobility of all beings. We'll end this meditation with a poem from Brad Aaron Modlin entitled, What You Missed That Day You Were Absent from Fourth Grade. Mrs. Nelson explained how to stand still and listen to the wind, how to find meaning in pumping gas, how peeling potatoes can be a form of prayer. She took questions on how not to feel lost in the dark. After lunch, she distributed worksheets that covered ways to remember your grandfather's voice. Then the class discussed falling asleep without feeling you'd forgotten to do something else, something important, and how to believe the house you wake in is your home. This prompted Mrs. Nelson to draw a chalkboard diagram detailing how to chant the Psalms during cigarette breaks, and how not to squirm for sound when your own thoughts are all you hear. Also, that you have enough. The English lesson was that I am is a complete sentence. And just before the afternoon bell, she made the math question look easy, the one that proves that hundreds of questions and feeling cold and all those nights spent looking for whatever it was you lost and one person add up to something. May we all know that I am, you are complete sentences. So we will take a break, a 6-minute break until 11 a.m. And just notice how you feel right now. Any stillness, a little quieter, sensing that inner brightness, that nobility and dignity. Take that with you on your break and then come back. Maybe don't even check your phone for messages in the next 6 minutes. Just come back and we'll talk with each other then. Now we'll wait for everybody to come back. I hope you had a good break. Few minutes, not much of a break. Yeah. All right, I think we'll just begin right on time here and folks will come back and good. So this idea, it's not so much an idea, it's true, this piece of experiencing and connecting with our inner nobility, this piece of dignity that is inside each one of us. We all know what trying times we've been in and the unrest that's all around us, which is part of why I want to talk about this today, because for me, I find it stabilizing. I find that when there's chaos around, I need to come back to what is really true for me, and the stability of sitting practice, the stability of connecting with Sangha is very stabilizing for me, and I find that it is what's true. It's really a beautiful place to be. It's refuge, right? Refuge in the Buddha, refuge in the Dharma, what the way things are, what the Buddha taught, and refuge in one another. And really to think about refuge in Sangha, our community, as such, I hope for you, it is for me, an immediate way of experiencing connection and belonging. Even though we obviously we're here in this digital way, we are here. So that first piece of the Abhidhamma, the Buddhist psychology, to see the inner nobility of ourselves and each other. And the second of these principles is compassion is our deepest nature. It arises from our interconnection with all things. And we know that, you know, I think that we can forget it, but I think that we find over and over again, every single time the heart is moved because we see some amount of pain and empathy arises. Something moves the heart and compassion is there. And we know how connected everything is to everything else. It makes more sense to me when I think about this next teaching from the Buddha that I know I say all the time because I really think it's true, which is you can search the whole world over and not find anyone more deserving of your love than yourself. I mean, in our culture that dismisses us, that we have a tendency to second guess ourselves, that when we question what is true or what is the truth, what is true is we really need to care for ourselves. And by caring for ourselves, we naturally start caring for others. I want to tell you about a book I'm excited to read that I've just heard some snippets about that I think is an important book. Elizabeth Lesser, who is an author, co-founder of the Omega Institute in Rhinebeck, New York, longtime meditator, has a brand new book out called Cassandra Speaks. Cassandra Speaks, When Women Are the Storytellers, the Human Story Changes. And this comes back to strong back, soft front, taking our place in the world. And it's based on the myth, the Greek myth of Cassandra. And I was reminded about it. I had, you know, mythology in high school. It was the last time I took a mythology class. So I forgot about who Cassandra was. And some of you may know, she was this beautiful priestess who the gods wanted. And she kept rebuffing the men and rebuffing the gods, including Apollo, and excuse me, including Zeus. And then Zeus's son, Apollo, said, I think I can get to her. I think I can do it. And so he wooed her and promised her the gift of clairvoyance if she would just have him. And she thought that sounded pretty good. And so when she said, yeah, I'd love the gift of clairvoyance, he said, okay, but you know, in exchange, you need to have me. And so she rebuffed him and said, no, I'm not going to be with you. And he was outraged. How could this woman reject him? So the story goes that he spat in her mouth and said, okay, you will still have the gift of clairvoyance for the rest of your life, but no one will believe you. No one will believe you. And that's what happened in the myth. And so she saw what was to come. She saw the armies inside the Trojan horse, and she foretold what was going to happen, but nobody believed her. So what is that like for any of us of any gender to not be believed, right? To have a sense of, this is who I am. This is the dignity. This is the nobility. This is what I'm talking about. But to not be taken seriously, to not be believed. And what does that do to us in our ability to believe ourselves, to stand in our own lives? So this piece of strong back, soft front is important. This is what I want us to explore. And Elizabeth Lesser comes from a Zen background. And in Zen, she's had many teachers, she says, but Zen was her first place of learning. If you know about Zen, you know that posture is incredibly important. Everything is posture. Everything that is done specifically and with dignity and nobility and in exactly a certain way, because it really invites this presence of mind that is willing to be right here, right now, to see exactly how our lives are. But what Elizabeth Lesser does is she equates strong back, soft front with do no harm and take no shit. Have you ever heard that expression? I imagine you have. So I want to talk about that a little bit, because what does that actually mean? How do we relate to do no harm and take no shit? Last time I was here, we talked a lot about do no harm. We talked about refuges. We talked about precepts and how they are pillars in our lives and hold us up. So I have a lot of background in small business, and it used to be the last business I had for 20 years was a laundromat. I know many of you know that. And in the employee's back room, we had a bumper sticker that said, do no harm. And it was a regular conversation in our staff meetings about what that meant. And really what, you know, we have to work with what that means. And one day somebody said, well, it means don't take any shit, but be nice to people. So we were talking about that. So you know this experience of being a customer. We have a mythology that says the customer is always right. Well, that is not true. And hopefully you know that it is not true, because we are all customers and we all know that we're not always right. We all have a right to be heard, but we're not correct just because we may be spending money in a business at an establishment that means that we get to choose how things are going to be there. So just expanding this out a little bit. So when I think of strong back, I think that's the place of take no shit. Because when we can have that strength of our backbone, we know who we are. And it's born out of our direct experience. And this is how we relate it to our Dharma practice. The Buddha said, don't believe me, find out for yourself what works. So through our practice, through our life experience of taking shit, right? Not knowing who we are, and then coming back to figuring out, wait a minute, I have a right to be here. These are my values. Through this clarity and presence of mind, our mindfulness, then we get to cultivate and tap into a very vibrant, alive wisdom that really leads to perspective, that really leads to equanimity. And when I say alive wisdom, what I mean by that is that, you know, there are all kinds of wisdom traditions. There's all kinds of good wisdom. But what is the wisdom that is inside of you, that you rely on, that you've discovered for yourself through relationships, through your whole life, that actually holds you up, that gives you that strong back, that allows you to say, no, that doesn't work for me? That's the take no shit. It's not rigid. It is absolutely not rigid. It's this place of knowing who we are and being able to operate from a very grounded, rooted place, just like Diane described, that tree, right? So there's that tree and we have deep roots. And I often think sometimes we use the roots image in meditation. I do for myself, and I imagine these roots that grow deep into the earth, but they're strong, but they're flexible. And flexibility allows us perspective and equanimity, that place of not being run over. And so that posture of take no shit doesn't have to be rigid at all. It can be quite flexible, but we just know who we are. And then soft front, do no harm. That's where how I feel the do no harm, because it just energetically feels like this, when the front of my body is soft, it's receptive. It can feel more, and it balances the strength of the back. We can't, if we just have strong back, strong front, nothing's going to get through. This is how I relate to it. If we have soft back, soft front, we may lose our stability. So this is all imagery, and I get it. We're using these images as metaphor, as a way to experience how we balance standing our ground, what is important to us, connecting our lives with our values through this metaphor of strong back, soft front. The other thing Elizabeth Lesser says that I thought was really beautiful was, what we need to do is put a musculature to our caring. What a great phrase. Put a musculature to our caring. So when we show up with having good boundaries and clarity of who we are, we're doing it with kindness. We're doing it with awareness. We don't have to be mean. We don't have to be harsh at all. So this is how these connect. And so then for me, what I think I get out of strong back, soft front is a free heart. This is the place I want to be. I want my heart to be big and free and able to tolerate the chaos that we're in without being destroyed. It doesn't mean I won't be sad. It doesn't mean I won't be heartbroken. But I'm free enough because it's supported by this strong back and my commitment to non-harming. Are you with me on this? Is this making sense to you? I see some nods. Thank you. Okay, great. Thank you, Marcy. I see that. That's great. Thanks. So why does this matter? I mean, I just said a million reasons why it matters, but I just want to tell you a little bit about my own story, my own background, and why I think all of this leads to this practice of wise livelihood. And we'll talk specifically what the Buddha taught on the definition of wise livelihood. But I think that when I think of wise livelihood, I'm thinking about it as like, it's not just what we do to make money. It's how we live our lives. And it is a factor on the Eightfold Path that doesn't get a whole lot of attention. So I want to bring it in. So why this matter, how it works, how it's worked for me. In the very beginning of my working life, in my early 20s, I was a nurse. And that's what I thought I was going to be doing in my life. And I was very young. I was 22 years old, and I was completely ill-prepared for what I was entering into. The amount of suffering, the amount of trauma, the amount of death every single day that I was exposed to. And I had absolutely no real warning. I mean, you can go to nursing school, you can go learn the ropes, but as far as what does it mean to show up and be in an emergency room where people are coming in with, you know, all kinds of trauma. And I was a little kid. I mean, I think a 22-year-old is a little kid. And I did not have the emotional capacity to really know what I was in for. Weak back, very soft front, very scared heart when I think about it like that. And not to mention that it was such a difficult experience, the work itself, but it was also a toxic environment. The politics in a hospital and the amount of Cassandras, the depth of Cassandra syndrome that was going on. Don't believe that little nurse, that kind of degrading, dismissive expression, how we treat nurses and teachers in our culture often as less than. I don't want to get started on that. But it was not a good environment for me because I was seeing that people's innate dignity was really being dismissed and harmed. And there was something in me that knew I didn't belong there. And one day I came home, I had little kids. My children were both under 4, I'm sure. And my husband said to me, you know, you don't have to do this. You don't have to do this job. And I'll never forget that, because here was my beloved saying to me, you have a choice. This is not required of you. And it was a moment that my world really opened up. I didn't have to stay doing something that was harming me, and by extension, not good for my family. So from there, I was lucky enough to go into small business, and I went into a business that I created with my mom that was a job placement company for nurse practitioners and physician assistants. And I helped people get jobs all over California. And it was a wonderful way to use what I felt then were my nursing skills of supporting people and helping people in something that really mattered, getting jobs that they really wanted. And so it was the beginning of bringing people together. And I did that, for about 10 years. Into the mid-90s, and then I switched because I was getting lonely, because at that time the whole job was done, my whole business was done over the phone, through the mail, and fax machines. We weren't doing internet then, you know, this was the 90s, it was really different. And then things shifted and I got lonely and I realized I needed to do something that was in my community, that was really part of my community. And after, it's a long story how this happened, but I ended up opening a laundromat. Now talk about a community business. That's exactly what it was. And it's in the middle of a college town, a big store. And for the next 22 years, I had this laundromat that I sold a year ago. And it was fantastic because I got to be with all kinds of people, had many employees, and you know, laundry is a common denominator. Everybody has it. It doesn't matter who you are. And so my business partner and I made a mission statement. And the mission statement was that the name of the store was Emerald City. Emerald City Laundry would be a clean and dignified, respectful place. Clean, dignified, safe, and respectful for everybody to do their laundry and everybody to work. And that was the bar. And it felt really in line with my values. And this was how I was starting to understand about Wise Livelihood, that when our work is in line with our values, then we can flourish. Then we can really show up. And so it was great. You know, we had that store really worked. It was, I have many, many stories, and I know I've brought them in here periodically, and they're fun to talk about all the wild things that happened in that store. But I got to be in my community and I felt really alive. I felt that peace of I'm in the right place. And at the same time, I was a mother and raising my kids and family and my husband and, you know, trying to bring it all together. And it was during that time that I was really getting involved in the Dharma and starting to see how happiness and unhappiness were directly my responsibility, that they really, what I did and what I didn't do affected how I was all the time. I started seeing how the Four Noble Truths work, how that it is true that life is imperfect, that suffering is real, and that there's a cause, but it doesn't have to be that way, and we can work with this. So it started really, my world started to expand and I started having this bigger perspective around my work life and how that was relating to my growing Dharma life and how making practice our whole life is really what we're doing and how strong back, soft front, free heart is an expression of our whole life of practice. So that gets me to what is the traditional definition of wise livelihood, just to lay that groundwork. And you'll see that it's certainly a reflection of what was happening 2,600 years ago when the Buddha taught. And then we have the great permission from ourselves, I would say, and all of our teachers to expand on this, to be creative with it, to make it relatable. All right, so from the Buddha, this is what wise livelihood is. One should earn a living legally, peacefully, without coercion or violence, honestly, without trickery or deceit, and in ways that do not entail harm or suffering for others. Well, I think that's pretty true still, right? I mean, wouldn't that be wonderful if this is what we saw all around us, that it's legal and peaceful and honest and doesn't cause harm? Five specific kinds of livelihood were avoided, and this is mostly for monastics. So just as to give you some background, dealing in weapons, dealing in living beings, including raising animals for slaughter, as well as slave trade and prostitution, dealing in meat production or butchery, in poisons or intoxicants. So, you know, you could look at that and take that in for yourself. You know, and this comes into the entire practice of non-harming. How do we relate to animals, intoxicants, fertilizers that are poisons? All kinds of things. We can look at how this really is inside of our culture. The other thing that he said about wise livelihood that I think is really important, any occupation that violates right speech, or wise action, our precepts, is a wrong form of livelihood. Any occupation that violates wise speech, is it truthful, is it kind, is it helpful, is it timely, or our precepts, is the wrong kind of livelihood. So this is what our practice is supporting us to develop all the time, is to keep front and center, is what I'm doing in support of living a life of non-harming? And can I keep studying what non-harming is? How does this really work? So I think now we can shift and take it into this contemporary definition. And I want to talk with us all about this. I think this is really interesting. It includes our lifestyle choices. It's not just what we do to earn money. And it's really important to make this distinction. It's how I look at it anyway, but it's how we live our lives, our choices. What do we do with our time? What do we consume? What do we buy? What is our relationship to recycling and garbage and landfill? In my community, we can't recycle anymore. And it's so, goes against everything. And how many years it took us to get really good at the habit of recycling, and now they don't take it anymore, especially for those of us who live rurally and we don't get garbage service, and we have to be careful about how much garbage we produce and take it to the dump ourselves. That's what we do. And all the years of separating everything and being careful, it doesn't exist. A piece of impermanence. So we have to look at what we're consuming, because it's going into the landfill, what we can't use, what we don't. Anyway, our job choices. What are our job choices? What are our housing choices? Too big, too small. I live in a house that's too big now because our kids aren't here anymore. And at some point, we need to shift that. Maybe. I mean, we do, but it brings up lots of different value systems. So, you know, you can see how one little piece is a domino effect. And so this is not to be critical of ourselves, but to be aware, but to be present and to really keep these issues alive and to be willing to just not be on automatic in our lives. What are our transportation choices? You know, and now in a time of COVID, it's been much more difficult in this pandemic if we're going anywhere, can we even carpool? Is it safe to be in a car with another person? Is it safe to be on public transportation? These questions arise, and I don't have the answer, but this is part of what I think wise livelihood brings, the conversation it brings us into. What do we do with our resources, our money? How do we use it? Some have money to save, some don't. Some have money to invest, some don't. And so just to be aware of where our money goes, how we vote with our dollars. Gil Fronsdal, beautiful Bay Area teacher, says, Wise livelihood is a practice that cultivates a deep inner sensitivity that simultaneously awakens a greater responsibility for the world while being less weighted down by the world. I think that last piece, we don't have to be so weighted down. What we want to do is stay aware. Wise livelihood is a practice that cultivates a deep inner sensitivity that simultaneously awakens a greater responsibility for the world without being weighted down by the world. I love that because this is what our practice does. It gives us a greater sensitivity for the world. And when we have a greater sensitivity, we tend to take care of it better. I'm sure many of you have heard the expression, protect what you love. We protect what we love. So can we fall in love with this earth, with this world? This is wise livelihood. And how do we find our place in it? This can be a very long process. It took me, like I said, you know, I shared with you my own process. It took me a long time. The end of the story that I didn't say is entirely is that I did sell the laundromat a little over a year ago, and now this is my job. I get to share Dharma. And I feel like I am at a place now where everything that has led to this moment was necessary to lead to this moment, that this is how I can be a nurse in the world. This is how I can care for my heart and help to care for yours. This is the best nursing work I've ever done. And all of getting back into the community, doing something as mundane and necessary as laundry. So it all, you know, there's a place for all of it. So, you know, that question that many of us had growing up that says, what do you want to be when you grow up? We really hated that question, like hated it. And that's a true, yeah, I really did. I hated that question because I had no idea. And it felt like it put so much pressure on me to have some grand goal that was seen in the eyes of my judgmental family about what it means, what it meant to, like, oh yeah, she knows who she is, what she wants to do. She's got a noble goal. I had no clue. But my favorite story about this I have no idea if it's true, but I'm going to just believe it because it's a good story. The story goes that when John Lennon was about 8 years old, the assignment in school was, what do you want to be when you grow up? And he said, happy. And the teacher said, you don't understand the question. And he said, no, you don't understand life. That's it, right? What do you want to be when you grow up? I want to be happy, and I am. It doesn't mean, and when I say happy, I don't mean Hallmark happy. I mean a steady current of contentment that allows me to manage the shit, basically, that allows me to manage the natural ups and downs, to have the strong back, soft front, that kind of equanimity. That's what I want to be when I grow up. That's it. So the central question about our jobs and our lives is we have to begin with some sort of inner spark, right? How do you know? What is that thing that sparks you? And can you have the courage? Not even audacity. I was going to say audacity is the word that came to mind, but the presence of mind, that knowing it's right, that nobility and dignity to follow that spark. Rumi said, let yourself be silently drawn by the strange pull of what you really love. It will not lead you astray. When I first heard that, I thought, oh man, that I needed that when I was a teenager, to trust that silent pull. Let yourself be silently drawn by the strange pull of what you really love. It will not lead you astray. So we come back to what is pulling us? Can we bring our ethical lives into that? So what we love, does it ask ourselves, does it harm anyone? Does it help others? Is it meaningful? Is it satisfying? The Chinese artist Lily Yang said, "I followed my passion and was guided by the light inside of me. That light does not belong to me alone. It's innate in all of us. Everyone has it. But more often than not, we choose not to see it. Our practice to see the inner nobility of all beings, including ourselves, is asking us to pay attention to that inner light and to follow it, because that's what brings us out. And when what is really important and lights us up, when we allow that to come out, we're our best selves. And the world needs our best selves. When a diversity of it, because what lights me up isn't going to be what lights you up, maybe. I mean, I don't really know that, but we need all of these different sparks. And then, you know, when we start getting connected to what really lights us up and doing that in the world, then our values get expressed through our work. And we can check that with ourselves. Is my work an expression of my values? And if it's not, that is really degrading to the heart. And that's the place to know, wow, this is not in line with what is important to me, with my values, and to try to find a way out of that. And I know that can be really hard for some who are in a job they can't help because they're paying the rent. And so I'm not saying, I am not dismissing that at all, but to know that we want to know what we're doing when we're doing it. So if our values are in line, to really experience that, to feel it. If they are not, to try to do what we can to shift it. Wendell Berry said, "What I stand for is what I stand upon." It's true. Who are we really? So we look at our work in all those ways. What are the consequences of it for me, for others? Is it in balance? Am I working too much? Am I not working enough? Is it nourishing? Is it draining? Is it both? Because that's just true. Sometimes it's both. Can we stay connected to that light, to that motivation, that intention? Does it fuel our determination to keep going? And you know, we're not going to always get it right. We talked about that earlier. We're just not. And so what? Right? You know, when we don't get it always right, we just course correct. I love the ability to course correct. Thomas Edison said, "I have not failed. I just found 10,000 ways that won't work." I have not failed. I've just found 10,000 ways that won't work. What if we could be that kind to ourselves? To say, oh, that didn't work. Okay, begin again. We don't have to beat ourselves up. And it can be frustrating, obviously, you know, if we're working on something for a while and it really doesn't work and we've put a lot of energy and effort into it. It doesn't mean it's not hard, but we can do hard things. So what if we're retired and not in those kinds of active jobs anymore? It doesn't mean that wise livelihood doesn't apply to us when we're talking about what is it that we do with our time. How do we manage our resources? I don't just mean money. I mean everything, our time, our capacities, our energy. What are we engaged in? Does it keep me alive in my life? And then from the deeper, maybe spiritual practice, this piece of the importance of cultivating compassion and empathy, does the way we lead our lives lead to compassion, peace, and freedom? Does it help insight and generosity and kindness get nurtured and come out? Does it support our well-being? Really important question. Does this support my well-being? And if it doesn't, can we find a way to shift that? And what I love about all of this that the Buddha said is to honor your own path. And in the Dhammapada, the Buddha said, "Whatever path of action you find that brings good and happiness to all, follow this way like the moon in the path of the stars." That is one of my favorite passages because it lets me be me and it lets you be you and we can shine together in that. Whatever path of action you find that brings good and happiness to all, follow this way like the moon in the path of the stars. Strong back, soft front, free heart. So let's talk with each other. I'd love to hear your contributions, your reflections, questions, anything. And I'm going to read you a poem to end. And just so many thanks to you all for showing up. And let this poem be our dedication of merit that all beings be safe and come to the end of suffering. This is called Neighbors from James Cruz. Where I'm from, people still wave to each other. And if someone doesn't, you might say of her, she wouldn't wave at you to save her life. But you try anyway. Give her a smile. This is just one of the many ways we take care of one another. Say, I see you. I feel you. I know you are real. I wave to Rick, who picks up litter while walking his black labs, Olive and Basil, hauling donut boxes, cigarette packs, and countless beer cans out of the brush beside the road. And I say hello to Christy, who leaves almond croissants in our mailbox and mason jars of fresh-pressed apple cider on our side porch. I stop to check in on my mother-in-law, more like a second mother, who buys us toothpaste when it's on sale and calls if an unfamiliar car is parked at our house. We're going to have to return to this way of life, this giving without expectation, this loving without conditions. We need to stand eye to eye again, to keep asking, no matter how busy, how are you? How's your wife? How's your knee? Making this talk, we insist on calling small, though kindness is what keeps us alive. Neighbors by James Cruz. Thank you, everybody. It's such a delight. Be well over the next week. Take good care. Stay safe. Take care of your hearts. Strong back, soft front, soft heart. See you next Wednesday.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.